Hi, hello. We have a fun episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. First, Steve and I talk about an awesome Game 7 between the Oklahoma City Thunder and the San Antonio Spurs. We salute the Oklahoma City Thunder for their run, and then we dig into the upcoming NBA Finals matchup. We got the Spurs. We got the Knicks. It's a rematch of the NBA Cup Finals. We are excited to dig into the nuts and bolts of that series. And then from there, we shift to the W side. As promised, we got to talk about the Golden State Valkyries. They have been a filthy defense. They have been a good offense that looks a little different than last year. So we talk about some of the changes and some of the early key performers for them. And then we talk about the Indiana Fever defense again. The last two games haven't been fun. There's been a lot of conversation around what their scheme is. Steve and I have a nuanced conversation about that and some of the non-negotiables within it. We had a lot of fun on this episode. Stick with us. Let's have some fun. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, happy Monday. How are you? Let's do that jazz indeed. We're going short and sweet because we have plenty of hoops to get to. First, Steve, we are coming off of an absolutely electric Game 7 between the Oklahoma City Thunder and the San Antonio Spurs. The Spurs on the road, Steve. A 111-103 victory in this game. Victor Wembanyama had himself a day. Julian Champagne had himself a day. Felt like they just traded offensive rebounds per half between these two teams. But ultimately, I'm glad we didn't get the Game 7 where one team just makes shots, the other one doesn't, and then by the time we get midway through the third quarter, it's just like cooked. We got like a genuine back and forth. And like watching that game, before even digging into the actual analysis or anything we want to get to, it was fun to feel that basketball game. It was fun to feel the haymakers that both of these two teams kind of tossed back and forth in each other. It was cool to see like all of the main characters, or most of the main characters, I guess we'll get there later. Most of the main characters had a moment in this one where it's like, oh, that guy is here. Victor Wembanyama set the tone early. That second quarter from Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Julian Champagne knocking down shots, getting key offensive rebounds. We want to mention him again. It was just fun to see that kind of battle, to see Mark Dagnall trying to find different lineups. He burned the timeouts early in that fourth quarter, trying to steal some like, it was just an epic end to what was a fantastic series, in my opinion. So I guess to toss it to you, Steve, how did you soak in that Game 7? What kind of stood out to you? And just kind of where are you now heading as we get closer to the final starting this week?
I mean, what more could you have asked for in a Game 7 with a trip to the NBA Finals on the line than what the Spurs and Thunder did? They went back and forth. And, you know, you mentioned players having big-time moments. It's hard to go down the list and not see people kind of step up to the plate, to your point. And I think the margins in that game were so slim. It was such a back-and-forth battle. I think that's the thing that hopefully people will remember as we go forward, because of how evenly matched these teams were and because of how much they poked at each other and working to kind of contain Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, working to keep the ball in front, Oklahoma City finding ways to make you pay, San Antonio trying to find the right movement against Oklahoma City's defense. They get a rebound, they make you pay. Like, it was just, no one ever fully took grasp of it until the Spurs just kept swinging. And I think the biggest thing is the Spurs went out and took this one. And so you mentioned everyone making all sorts of big plays, Kelvin Johnson making big shots. Stephon Castle continuing a playoff run. Dylan Harper making big shots. Wimby set the tone, but this is a team effort as far as we're not losing this game. They had the swagger about them on both ends of the floor. And Oklahoma City was game to try and swing back. They just couldn't get back over the top. And I think the biggest thing is, like, Shai was really, really hard to deal with. And they needed every portion of him being tough to deal with in this one. He was so good, they put the doubles back on the table.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where OKC made San Antonio pay, and then San Antonio gets a turnover. It was just some very fun basketball. And it's one of those things where I'm glad we got to experience it. I'm glad we got to see it. I'm glad we got to see a conference finals live up to that kind of stature, because it's not usually something that happens. And I mean, we're sitting here, talk about it soon. It's going to be the eighth straight year we'll have a new champion. Yeah. It's hard to win. It's hard to win in the NBA, I'm telling you.
Very much so. Like, this is something that Shai talked about in kind of the exit interviews. And I think a lot of Thunder players and coaches kind of hit on the same thing. Like, this is hard to do. Like, we put ourselves in position. We ultimately didn't get it done. But the journey was what the journey was. And I think as I kind of zoom out on what this Thunder season was overall, Steve, they were the best team in basketball. Had the highest won the most games, had the highest net rating, had the best defense in the league, nearly a top five, was a top five offense for most of the year, eventually slid to six per Cleaning the Glass. They did this with nine players, 10 if you want to include Kenrich Williams. Like, so many of their players missed double-digit games this year. And for them to be, as you've often called them, machine-like through all of this, and then you get this postseason run. You don't know how available Jalen Williams is going to be. You have A.J. Mitchell, who is fantastic, and then you don't know if he's coming back and he ultimately doesn't. And for OKC to search for these amount of answers and to deal with this Spurs team for seven games, I think is commendable in and of itself. Like, obviously, a Thunder fan doesn't want to hear commendable when you just lost on your home floor. You're not going back to the finals. But, like, this was an incredible season for them when you consider the context of what they were dealing with from an injury perspective. And even looking back to this series, like, I guess you zoom out for the year itself, I don't think anyone should have been surprised that the Spurs won it. Like, you always sprinkle in grains of salt for, like, regular season matchups and things. But we had a large enough sample to at least acknowledge the Spurs pose very specific problems to the Oklahoma City Thunder in a way that the other 28 teams in the league just do not. And for this to be seven in the midst of the Thunder dealing with these injury issues and Shea trying to solve this defense, and the Thunder as a whole just trying to solve Wimby. Like, it was just a fun back and forth, and I don't want that to be lost just because of how the season ultimately ended. And so I just did want to give a quick salute to the Thunder on that front. I guess while we're on the Thunder, the one thing I did want to ask you about, Steve, it was, if we're talking about player performances, it was a quiet one for Chet Holmgren, to say the least, in that Game 7. And I think we talked about in the lead-up to this game, one, the Thunder were just going to need a better version of him, and kind of wondered how much of that is his own aggression versus OKC maybe dialing up different things to try to put him in position. Mark Dantnot talked about taking that performance kind of personally. Like, it's my job to make sure that Chet is in the best position to succeed, or the team itself to be in position to succeed. And that's something I'm going to do some soul searching on, et cetera. And so I guess as you were watching this live, or even if you, as you take the step back from the Game 7, the performance was what the performance was, but like, how much of that did you feel was San Antonio making life tough on him versus Chet maybe missing some opportunities in and of himself?
I'm more intrigued to see how you absorb the Chet Holmgren performance. To me, it's the Spurs have the personnel to kind of be able to poke at Chet in a certain way. And so he's not going to get automatic easy ones. And in the positions where he would get easy ones, that's Victor Wembanyama that may be guarding him. So I'm intrigued with how you feel about Chet Holmgren. How did you absorb this performance?
In the moment, I was very disappointed. And I say disappointed largely because there felt like there were pockets on the perimeter at the very least where I just would have liked to see him kind of empty the clip, so to speak. I think we have both acknowledged, like, teams going back to the 2024 playoff run, it's like, hey, Chet kind of has to solve teams putting wings on him. What is the self-creation going to look like? What is the overall scoring aggression going to look like, et cetera? We talked about that during the 25 playoff run, and the Thunder ultimately win the title. We talked about that in this series, and the Spurs ultimately got eliminated. So, like, there wasn't a new problem. You know, talked about it on Friday. I thought Devin Vassell was doing a pretty good job of him during the series. When Julian Champagne got the matchup sometimes, he did a solid job, and on the other end, he got more comfortable attacking him. I just would have liked to have seen Chet force the issue a little bit more. Even if it wasn't the full-fledged drives because Wimby was always lurking, I would have loved to come on here and say it kind of stinks that Chet went 1 of 6 from three. But at least he put the shots up. Like, the two shot attempts is where I'm just like, Chet, give yourself a chance to have the variance thing. It may not have been a clean look or a perfect context for you, but more aggression would have been lovely. And that's where I'm just like, I don't love the taste that leaves. Now, with that being said, I have seen and heard and read a lot of the discourse around that performance, and I feel like it has gone from Chet did not play well or Chet did not do his part to some other personal adjacent stuff that I just do not like and I'm not comfortable with, to be completely honest with you. I would love to just keep this basketball, but I think that's ultimately how I absorbed it. Like, the context was San Antonio deserves a lot of credit for making life difficult for him. I would have loved to have seen more aggression from him overall. And I think he should learn from this. You know, like, this sets up an offseason for him to get stronger, to tighten up the handle, to quicken the shot release, if that's what it's going to be. I don't know if he's going to actually alter his shot release point at this point, especially when he's coming off a regular season where he shot well from three. But there are areas to work on, by all accounts, his own account, Shea's account, Mark Dantnot talked about it. Like, he has a ridiculous work ethic, so I don't doubt that he's going to work hard in the offseason to get better. But yeah, it's just like, you were an all NBA caliber talent. You were a DPOY caliber guy. And for this series to go the way it went, it's disappointing based on what the talent level is and ultimately what we saw. So I just wish we would have gotten a better version and a more aggressive version of Chad. That's kind of where I'm at.
Well said. Well said.
I appreciate it. The last thing I'll say on the Thunder front, then we can move to the NBA Finals, because, buddy, I am excited to talk about Spurs Knicks with you in particular, Steve. The other downside to OKC not only losing the series, but losing the series the way it did, is that it does open up this offseason in which the Jalen and Chet Max kick in. They're going to be deep in the second apron without making some moves. Think team option for Isaiah Hartenstein, team option for Lou Dort. They have some salary to move around. And so I am curious to see how OKC navigates this offseason. Is this going to be declining both the team options for Lou Dort, Isaiah Hartenstein, and trying to renegotiate a little bit lower to keep them, either get them out of the apron or just get them closer away from it? Are they letting those guys walk and just trusting some of these younger guys on rookie scale contracts to step into bigger roles? Are they going to make a trade? Like, I don't think, like, I've seen the noise. Like, I don't think they're going to move Chet. I don't think they're going to move Jalen Williams. Can't rule anything out with Sam Presti, but if I had to guess, I don't think they're going to go that drastic. Like, they almost made the finals despite missing Jalen Williams and AJ Mitchell. I don't think you overreact, but I am curious to see what they do with their core guys and how they absorb this series overall. We talked about this a little bit on Friday, Steve. Like, regardless of if OKC wins or loses the game seven, they have to look at the Spurs group like they gave us some problems this year, and we're going to have to contend with them if they're healthy for a very long time. And so now that we know it's officially a loss, how do they soak that in? What do they do around that? That's kind of what I'm curious about as we move forward.
I mean, they built this up a certain way. They'll find a way to continue to build it the way they want to. And for me, I think it's not necessarily, you don't have to focus your moves on specifically San Antonio. I think you have to continue to add to what you've built so far and maybe have a little bit more versatility, maybe have some more options. But I mean, you gave yourself a chance with people missing to a degree, and you fought all season long. So I don't think you have to change too much. You just got to continue to evolve and find the right fits to continue to kind of get back to where you want to be on top of the NBA.
Yeah, that's fair. I think that is fair. Also, quick shout out to Cason Wallace for an awesome game seven. He's, I think, also extension eligible this offseason. I don't think he's going anywhere. He earned himself some money with the way that he defended and the timely shot making that he displayed throughout the series. So I want to shout out Cason Wallace as well. Okay, that is the last time we're talking about the Oklahoma City Thunder for a little bit, at least until they package 12 and 17 and move up in the draft. I guess we'll see what happens on that front. But in all seriousness, we're going to take a break right here. And when we return, Steve, it is time to preview the NBA Finals tipping off on Wednesday night. I am excited about this matchup. We're going to have some fun. Stay tuned. And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot. And Steve, it is time to preview this year's NBA Finals. We have a rematch of the NBA Cup, Steve. We have the New York Knicks. We have the San Antonio Spurs. This was the finals matchup back in 1999. So that should be a fun callback. But quickly, to kind of set the stage for what this matchup is, so far in this postseason, the New York Knicks, they have been statistically the most dominant playoff team that we have ever seen. 12-2 right now. A net rating of nearly plus 22.100% per 100 possessions, which is insane. A 127 offensive rating, a 105 defensive rating, which is absurd. The San Antonio Spurs, as they got through the Portland Trail Blazers, the Minnesota Timberwolves, and then just the Oklahoma City Thunder, who are the best team in the league this year. 12-6 in the playoffs right now, nearly a plus 11 net rating on the postseason run so far. And you go through the regular season matchup, Steve, technically two, as the NBA Cup final doesn't count as a regular season game, but three matchups in total. The New York Knicks won two of those matchups, winning the NBA Cup 124-113 in two of the regular season matchups. The Spurs with a 134-132 victory back on December 31st. That was the Julian Champagny 11 made threes game, if you remember that one. And then a matchup in early March with the Knicks knocking off the Spurs 114-89. Some players missing across those matchups. But that is where we are. And so, Steve, as I toss it to you, where does your intrigue start with this finals matchup between these two teams?
I mean, I think it's the battle between these two teams who have made the journey to get to the finals. And so you think about the possibility of two teams who maybe a lot of people didn't expect to be in a championship scenario, being four wins away from winning said championship. And what does that do to elevate them? And now how do they figure this out? I think that's going to be the most fascinating part, because someone's going to either swing big or figure something out very quickly, and you got to adjust extremely fast to what that is. And so is there going to be a comfort level that either team feels because of how they've gotten here? So if you're the Knicks, you know, is there something that San Antonio can throw at you that you have not experienced already? You've already dealt with, to a degree, hey, we're going to put a guard or a wing on Karl Anthony Towns. The Knicks do have strong defensive personnel to defend. I mean, the Knicks do have strong personnel to defend the Spurs guards. Can the Spurs kind of flip that on them? But have the Knicks dealt with that already? We've already seen that in these playoffs, so we're good to go there. Mm-hmm. Can we get Karl Anthony Towns rolling as a big? Yeah, we probably can, especially if we can get him some minutes against Luke Kornet late in the first, start of the second, depending on how San Antonio adjusts their sub pattern, because they had to do that in Oklahoma City. So how do we kind of adjust and unlock what we do? The difference here is, who does Victor Wembanyama guard, and is New York ready for his rotations to try and disrupt things? Because if you go back to the last time they played, New York was fine with switching everyone on Karl Anthony Towns. Half of that was because, hey, we'll give you this elbow catch, we'll give you this middle cut. The other part was Wembanyama would see it and just rotate. We know that he's dictating terms and commanding things and kind of flying all over the place. So is New York going to be able to adjust to that? How does San Antonio want to deploy Wemby early? That, I think, is fascinating. How many matchups is Jalen Brunson going to be able to win in this one? Mm-hmm. Again, he's been used to being a featured player for the Knicks. And so it's not necessarily, hey, Brunson has to do X, Y, and Z, but the more he can kind of win matchups against De'Aaron Fox, take Champagne off the board, Stephon Castle is poke at you, then you have a blend. And so now, you know, can the Knicks also get all off-ball movement back on the table? That was one thing Cleveland was like, hey, we'd really like it if you did not do that thing with Karl Anthony Towns and use them as a hub. Can they now get that back on the table and just use movement as a way to kind of just mix things around? That's where it gets interesting to me. Like, I want to see the attempt. I want to see what it looks like. Because if you're looking at a series where the Knicks having OG who can guard Wemby but also can guard any of their guards, having an ability to feel like Jalen Brunson's been put in action a whole lot and he's held up, and Karl Anthony Towns been put in action a whole lot and he's held up, we can feel comfortable defensively. But at the same time, are you going to open Victor Wembanyama up as a roller? Is that going to get San Antonio more comfortable than they were in the Thunder series? Like, there's elements of, okay, what is your attempt going to be and how is the other team going to react to it? That's kind of where my starting point is with this series.
Okay, I'm right there with you. Like, I feel like we often talk about, once you get into the second round onward in the playoffs, it's a general, what did you learn from the previous series or previous series? What can you take? What can you be better at? What can you deploy based on who your opponent just faced? Like, did they see something that didn't feel great? And now we have the personnel to be able to do that better than their previous opponent. And so I think my mind goes there. But even before that, I kind of look at the Knicks as like, hey, because you have been so dominant, you have been chilling for quite some time. Not literally chilling, obviously, they're practicing things like that. But you've had a pretty long layoff while the Spurs going back and forth with the Oklahoma City Thunder for seven games every other game. And so from there, like, just looking at the game one, I'm just kind of like, who does that serve? Does that serve the New York Knicks? We're coming in fresher. Y'all coming off this battle. We can run. We can kind of establish set turns. Or does that favor the Spurs? Like, we just had to play that team, that defense. We're in rhythm right now. Y'all have to kind of ramp your way back up. We can set a tone early on. So, like, that's kind of my general game one question heading in. Like, how does the rest versus rust kind of play in? Oh, go ahead.
You're starting with rest versus rust. Wow.
I'm intrigued. Growing up. Hey, it's a new frontier for you, boy. But no, like, I am curious to see, like, how that part starts. And then as you get into the actual matchups, you nailed a lot of it, so I don't want to hang there too long. But the matchups, as they always do, intrigue me. But for this particular between this particular final series, it really does intrigue me. Because you have a San Antonio Spurs group where we have seen throughout the regular season and in this playoff run, Stephon Castle, we will ask you to defend literally anyone at any given time. If we want a cross match or we just want to put you on the best ball handler, we are fine with that. You go through some of the regular season through some of the regular season film between these two teams. We saw Stephon Castle on Karl Anthony Towns at times. so Victor Wembanyama can roam off of Josh Hart or insert non-shooter here, and we can get into some of those rotations. Is that how the Spurs want to start? Do they want to go with Castle on Karl-Anthony Towns? Or do they want Stephon Castle just hounding Jalen Brunson to the best of his abilities? And considering Stephon Castle is coming off a series where he dealt with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and on the high end, he was incredibly effective against him. On the low end, he got into some foul trouble. What does that look like when he's matched up with Jalen Brunson? So I'm fascinated by that portion, and you nailed it on the other end. Like, where do we want Karl-Anthony Towns in this series defensively? It's going to be an interesting one for me. Do we want the bigger body on Victor Wembanyama, as we saw the Thunder after game two say, actually, let's just keep a center on Wemby. Let's try to disrupt these roles as much as we can. Let's try to be physical, etc. Or do we want to get into our own bit of cross-matching? OG Anunoby has spent a good bit of time on Victor Wembanyama during the regular season matchups. Do we want to do that, let Cat roam, and kind of save him from some potential foul trouble? So, like, the matchup piece, it always fascinates me, Steve. You poke at me because of it. But, like, I think there's some pretty big decisions that are going to be established in game one. And I'm curious to see, like, who's able to set their own tone defensively based on how they match up and how well they defend and what the counters are going to be. Because I think that also bleeds into your points about, can we unlock Brunson, Cat, and pick and roller and handoffs? Can we get to the Cat hub work offensively? For the San Antonio Spurs, something that I had in my notes, what exactly is going to be the offensive approach for Victor Wembanyama? Do the Spurs, like, he is Wemby, so the Spurs ideally want him to be effective everywhere. We want drives, we want transition attacks, we want pick and roll, etc. But, like, what do they want to establish first with him? And based on the matchups, what can they establish first with him offensively? Can they set up those middle touches? I'm fascinated by how the Knicks want to deal with Wemby, and ultimately what the offensive approach for Wemby is going to be offensively in this series.
Well, this is, again, why it being a new series, as important as it is very interesting, because San Antonio, we just saw a series where, hey, Victor Wembanyama, you definitely need to be assertive early to set a tone. But we've seen San Antonio throughout these playoffs say, hey, you know what? We're going to let our defense establish what we're here to do. We're going to get out and let our guards have a chance to flow and attack and get downhill, and then we'll sprinkle Wemby in the different ways that we do, whether that's getting him off ball actions, whether that's having him in pick and roll as a screener, inverted pick and roll, elbow touches. The entire versatility box of Wembanyama is always something they can deploy. Will they have the same urgency they had in the Oklahoma City Thunder series? Gets very interesting. To your matchup point, I think for me, it's more so the timeliness of it. I wouldn't be surprised if the Knicks start out with Cat on Wembanyama and say, you know what, let's keep OG for a certain reason. The tricky part is, how do the Spurs want to handle it? Because Karl-Anthony Towns against a big has been lucrative for New York. It's been the secret sauce. So if they want to start small, okay, how do the Knicks adjust? Do they use Cat as a hub? Is that something that's fantastic? If you're the Spurs and you see Cat guarding Wemby, okay, this is something that's familiar. If they want to go with they have multiple wings that can throw at Wemby, which I think is the interesting factor. Throughout these playoffs, we've seen people put smaller people on Wemby. And some of the smalls are just the type where he's like, we're not doing this anymore. You know what I mean? Like, and
you're coming Caruso with me.
Like, Caruso and Drew were very, very active, but there are some of the times where it's just like, we're just going to get the ball here and go to work. And so, okay, do we want to just keep a big on Wemby and now limit ourselves that way? Or just expand as the game goes on? I think that's where it gets more interesting to me. What's the second attempt? Like, let's look at Jalen Brunson, for example. We've seen San Antonio throw double teams at Anthony Edwards and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. We've seen Jalen Brunson cycle through matchups. Will they double Jalen Brunson to start and say, you know what, we're not going to let you get into your dancing routine and get to your spot. We're going to actually try and dictate terms a little bit. Now, we saw they had success with Ant, and they could fly around. We saw Oklahoma City say, actually, I'm very glad that you did this. We're going to make you pay. And that kind of the back and forth they had there. So is that something that the Spurs will look at and say, you know what, in a key moment, let's get the ball out of Jalen Brunson's hands, let's play out of it. What that does offer up, though, is you being in rotation against the Knicks and allowing them to kind of face an attack and shoot against a tilted defense, depending on what lineups are out there, that could get tricky. So do you want to hand them a rotation, even though you're really good at it, especially when Wembanyama's in the game, or which one do you value more? That's where my head is like, okay, I think there's multiple ways they could do this. So if I'm the Knicks, I want Jalen Brunson to win as many matches as possible. I want him to get some of these traps and these doubles. If I'm the Spurs, we need to be able to have a lot of people that can guard him, make it tough, and we need to be able to mix in doubles when we can, and we have to be able to use Wembanyama smartly.
Yeah, I think just to bounce off of that, because I think this also goes into one of the battleground questions that I had. Something that we've talked about with this Knicks offense this year, as they've been looking for consistent flow, and they have certainly found it in this postseason, and even entering the postseason, they were starting to find that. One of the fascinating things about the Knicks is that even in their best moments, and we're flowing, we're getting side to side, we're using Cat as a hub, et cetera, they were still comfortable working late in clock and generating shots that were good for them late in the clock. Against the San Antonio Spurs, this is just one of the best defenses in basketball, and they pose problems for anyone. And we just saw that in the Thunder series. Two, specifically in relation to the double, Steve, because we saw them against Minnesota, where like, okay, we will just double Ant before he crosses the half court. We can do it early. Or if you do get late in the clock, there's six in the shot clock. Oh, now we're sending two. And I do wonder what those possessions are going to look like against the Knicks, as they are comfortable getting the six on the clock and just saying, Jalen Brunson, here you go. Get us something in the middle of the floor. If that now becomes, we are now sending, if Stephon Castle has the matchup, whether he switched on to him or just has it outright, okay, now here comes Devin Vassell. Or as we saw in the Thunder series, Shea's trying to set up an ISO on the left side of the floor. Here's Victor Wembanyama just roaming to the other side. We are just preloading this. You are going to see that body. If those start turning into double teams late in the clock, it's not that the Knicks can't handle it, but I am curious to see like how consistently they're able to kind of beat that kind of coverage if they see it. Because we saw it kind of sprinkled in during the regular season matchups, but we've seen the double teams really ramp up for the Spurs at points during this postseason run. How the Knicks play out of that, I think, could, I mean, one, you could just take that off the table for the Spurs if you beat it and hit it hard enough. And this is a Knicks team that has been excellent throughout this postseason run. But if you're comparing them to OKC and their overall three-point shooting and their overall three-point shooting volume, this is a different ordeal. OKC hit threes early in the series, Alex Caruso knocking them down, Casey Wallace, et cetera. If you're double-teaming and now it's Mikal Bridges from the corner, OG Anunoby from the corner, Landry Shamet when they get into some of their smaller lineups, he's knocking down threes. That feels different if you're running that gambit. So, like, the late clock battle, I think, is going to be an interesting one.
Well, let's hang here for a second, right? And I think it's very interesting because you mentioned a lot of different names. And I'm thinking about Victor Wembanyama, and I'm thinking about Victor Wembanyama roaming off Josh Hart, because eventually I think that's something that's going to happen. May happen early, may happen often, may be the thing. Who knows? The one thing I remember from the last time they played is people were not happy with Josh Hart for a lot of that game, but that man was committed to doing whatever it took to move around the basketball court. Hey, you need me to dribble handoff? Mm-hmm. I'll dribble handoff. Need me to cut? I'll cut somewhere. Hey, Kat, you want a flare screen? That's fantastic. I'm going to do something, and we're going to see what happens. Now, Josh Hart obviously came off some pretty good shooting series, but he's going to have an impact on both ends of the floor. They need his defense, and they need him to kind of have this glue effect for San Antonio. I mean, for the Knicks. The interesting part with Wembanyama's roaming, right? How would you say you're concerned it's going to impact Brunson and Cat more? Or is this something that impacts Mikal Bridges and OG Anunoby more? More so because of the timely drives that they have had at times during the playoffs. Like, we know they've made threes. Bridges had a huge Eastern Conference Finals. OG had a huge first round pre-injury. Are they going to be able to get to some of those? Well, I curled. Oh, that's Victor Wembanyama. Will they get the comfort in the mid-range or getting all the way to the paint? Is that the ultimate goal for the San Antonio Spurs? Let's mute them a little bit and then battle against the other two. What do you think about that thought that sprinkled in my head?
Oh, no. I think that is a fair one and a fun one. I think to directly answer the first part, the answer is kind of yes to me. As far as who it impacts more, I guess initially I would probably say I'm curious to see what that does to Brunson. And I think as you zoom out, if you do see more of those, if he sees more of those doubles, particularly late in the clock, what's interesting about this Knicks group compared to the Thunder group that the Spurs just saw is if this is double team swinging around, we don't want to get to the rim. Mikal Bridges is fine with pull-up middies. Like, he doesn't have to get there. So I don't know if you get the same turndowns or you get the same effect of Wimby at the rim. Obviously, he is still insanely good and you want to get fruitful shots at the rim. But if we're just talking about shot profile stuff, Mikal Bridges is fine with beating a closeout and taking a pull-up 12-footer. Like, he is good at that shot. He is comfortable taking that shot. I would be a little more interested in what OG Anunoby's shot-making looks like in that context. Again, not that he cannot knock down pull-ups, but I think you were talking about just kind of playing out of an advantage. OG is more natural, like, play finisher. We're taking these corner threes, and you just have the random 6 of 10 from three night. With Wimby there, if they are able to run him off the line, like, I wonder what those drives in particular are going to look like, if that makes sense. I think that's where my brain would go on that front.
I think it's fair. I have another question for you that I have thought of right now. Let's talk about the Spurs guards and how important their impact should be. And if I'm the Knicks, how do I look to attack them? Like, I think a lot of – I made the Darren Coyote joke last pod, and he had a great game seven. But is this an area where the Spurs guards may have a little bit more freedom in theory, where you get Castle and Harper and Fox bottling up the mindset they had to have against Oklahoma City and figuring out ways to be more impactful against the Knicks? Or, as you recall, the Knicks this whole playoff run have had to defend guards. So we've had to deal with C.J. McCollum, who had us in hell. We had to deal with Tyrese Maxey and Vijay Edgecombe. We had to deal with Donovan Mitchell and James Harden. Are they just more suited personnel-wise, and we've dealt with this before-wise, to kind of mute what force the Spurs guards play with? And will that be as impactful as my brain thinks it could be?
Ooh, I like this question. I think from a comfort, we have seen good guards before point. Like, I think the Knicks are going to be prepared to, like, deal with the importance of the Spurs guard play. I do think the guards are different enough. If we're talking about just the pure force that they drive with, like, Stephon Castle will put his shoulder into your chest and you will move. De'Aaron Fox is incredibly fast. I'm curious to see, like, what he's going to look like after these couple of days off now. Is he going to be closer to, like, 90, 91% in this series, get some of the explosion back? But, like, he has the speed, and also I can put my shoulder into your chest. Dylan Harper, as we saw in the back end of that series against OKC and the different points of this postseason overall, I will put my shoulder into your chest. And so that may take a few possessions where it's like, oh, okay, this is how I have to absorb these kind of hits with these guys. And ultimately, because one of the, like, margin things I was thinking of, you know, I'm going to hit on offensive rebounding at some point in this conversation. But I was also just kind of thinking about the turnovers in general. Like, one of the biggest reasons the Spurs were able to beat the Thunder is because the turnovers pretty much got cut in half if you split the series in half for them. The Knicks haven't really turned the ball over all that much during this postseason run, and the Spurs haven't forced a ton of turnovers, excluding the back end of this Thunder series. And so from a transition perspective, like, what does that do with the Spurs guards? If they're not able to get out and run to that degree, are the half-court drives a little bit more containable for this Knicks group? And that also just kind of circles back to how do the Knicks want to match up? Because if you do go traditional, let's say, all right, Kat, you are taking Wimby on early, don't get in foul trouble, do your job, etc. In theory, that does open up OG Anunoby if you want to say, hey, actually, let's just take away these Stephon Castle drives. I will duck under and switch if necessary. We're just putting you here. Mikal Bridges, we're putting all the length on De'Aaron Fox. Let's have some fun. Dylan Harper, when you come in, you have to deal with one of those guys, or Josh Hart, or Jose Alvarado if you're matching those bench minutes. Like, that chess match can get really interesting to me. But yeah, like, I think it's going to take a little bit of just to like how they want to attack and the force in which they do so. But if the Knicks are able to mute that at all, it kind of goes back to something that you said pretty consistently about the Spurs, Steve, in which their offense has been very good all year long. What is, like, the one thing? What is the pet thing that they get to, et cetera? Because the drives are just, we could just win those in the middle of possession. You don't have any fun with that. If they were to mute those, where do they go? What they try to poke at?
Well, I think the thing is, people, like, you want to think the Spurs offensive process is a certain thing. They're just kind of a built on ball movement. They're built on drive and kick. They're built on Victor Wembanyama being able to do different things. And then around that, we have these guards who can play in pick and roll, who can get dribble handoffs, who can kind of win matchups and open things up for us. So that can seem a little difficult when everything is so based on our defense is so good. We have a little bit of wiggle room, which is fun until they don't have the wiggle room, and now you got to figure things out in the fourth quarter. That's why they kind of, in that Thunder series, had just sustained stretches of really good basketball on both ends of the floor, and that's like, ooh, we can't score for a couple minutes. But they never stop playing with force. I think that's the one thing you have to remember. Like, they may not get the best shot. They may not make shots for a little bit, but it's very rare that they feel like, well, we just can't generate anything. I think that's where I'm intrigued to see how the Knicks handle and deal with that, because you're coming off facing like a Cleveland team where you knew exactly where the bread was going to be buttered to a degree, right? Like, you knew what was going to happen. The most Philly, you had to double draw Embiid. You knew Tyrese Maxey was going to do XYZ, but you also kind of knew exactly where the bread was buttered. Atlanta had you in a little bit early in that series, because it's like, you sure are pushing the ball and doing a few extra things, and CJ McCollum won't stop. So can San Antonio present a type of blend that is going to force the Knicks to have like sustained efforts on defense to where, okay, you got to drive and kick, you got to help and recover, you got to help and recover again. Like, is there a different pressure the Knicks will feel? Not to say that they have not seen something like this before, but are they going to be able to poke at them in ways that Cleveland couldn't consistently do? They missed shots, but they couldn't consistently get the Knicks in. You got to fly around. You got to make second efforts. Is that the focus that San Antonio should have to kind of just make the Knicks guard multiple things? Or is this just Jalen Brunson, we're going to find you. Karl Anthony Towns, going to find you too. And that's where we're at. What do you think?
See, this, I was literally about to ask you a Jalen Brunson question. So I love this setup. This is how we've been doing the podcast for a very long time. My two-part question that I was going to toss to you, Steve, was one on the matchup front, where do you start Jalen Brunson?
Champagne.
Are you putting just Champagne? Because I was like, do you put him on Champagne? Do you put him on Devin Vassell? And I feel like there is equity to either one, but also a risk to either one. Because I think with Champagne, what we saw in the, what we've seen all year long with Julian Champagne, like the calling card has been the 3-point shooting for him, but he can beat closeouts. He can drive, especially against smaller players. And as we saw throughout the regular season, in this postseason run, in this Thunder series, he can also get busy on the offensive glass. And so, like, does that put Jalen Brunson in a weird spot where, like, yes, I'm not worried about Julian Champagne, like, beating me off the bounce per se, but if I have to box out, are we giving up extra opportunities? Is there some jostling down low? I get like a random foul in the first quarter because I'm trying to box this dude out. Like, what does that look like? In addition to, I guess, circling back to your Spurs point of what they're trying to poke at, if the Spurs get into their double drag stuff with Julian Champagne and Victor Wembanyama as screeners, that flows into the second part of my question. Like, what is the Brunson coverage, do you think, in this series? I think they're going to try to mix in some things, but primarily, what do you think is going to be the best coverage for him? Is it just switching out and kind of showing the help behind it? Do you want to show and recovers from him? Because with the way that the Spurs can dial things up with their actions, on or off the ball for that matter, which goes to the Vassell point, like if you put him on him, does that just open up the pin downs for Wemby? And like, you're not wanting to switch Jalen Brunson on to Victor Wembanyama. What do we think the Brunson cover? What do we think the Brunson matchup is going to be? And what do we think the coverage for him is going to be when the Spurs try to get him in action?
I think he starts on Champagne, but he's going to see a little bit of everybody. He's going to have to hold up against Castle, against De'Aaron Fox, against Dylan Harper. Like, there are going to be moments where he's going to have to guard them. But I think what you want to do is do well enough to where this is not a thing you're going to attack 19 times a game. And I think that's where we'll probably start with show and recover, because they usually start with show and recover. But they've been willing to switch him throughout these playoffs. And you know what? Mm-hmm. Keep the ball in front. Do your job. Let's see what happens. And so the more that he can just hold up, okay, now San Antonio looks to attack somewhere else. And so I think it's interesting to see, like, okay, what's your philosophy defensively with Brunson and Cat, with how well they've held up to this degree? Are you afraid that it will change in these finals, is where my brain kind of goes to. But I mean, I think we'll get show recover the switch. And I think it'll be interesting to see how much Cat switches. If that happens, is there going to be two on the ball? Are they going to stick with drop? Is that going to open up Wemby as a roller? Like, I think there's interesting concepts here, especially because if you're San Antonio, you can put a Stephon Castle on Cat and turn him into a switch. And now let's see how you handle that. As I said earlier, all that sounds good, but you still got the Wembanyama. I'm going to rotate behind and figure out how to cause havoc. So there's no auto guarantee in this series to a degree.
Yeah, I think that part, that's where it's going to get fun for me. Can I toss you a second unit question, Steve?
Well, you already went with Jalen Brunson matchup concern because of offensive rebound rate, so go ahead.
I am so sorry to disappoint, but I think just in general, whose second unit do you trust more heading into the series? That they both have been very good for their respective teams throughout this postseason run, and we've seen swings from both sides.
I mean, here's the thing. I think the tricky part is you probably would lean San Antonio because of how well Dylan Harper's played and how much force Keldon Johnson's played with. I think with the Knicks, their bench has bought in and been a key part of it. It's just, okay, whose series is this going to be? Mitchell Robinson's injury is going to play through it, but that looms. So is this a Deuce McBride series? Is this a Landry Shamet series? Like, who's the person that's going to make things elevate? And what's the rotation look like? Because I think what's sneaky is, right? One, if you're San Antonio, you just need to hope Luke Kornet doesn't look anything like he did against Thunder, because the Thunder saw him on the court and said, hey, man, we're just going to go to work, and that is what it is. You have to take that off the table if you are San Antonio. You got to get him back in, because San Antonio's strength is kind of, okay, Wimby can have some weird rotation runs where he has a big stint, sits, comes back to end the first, starts the second. The Knicks kind of worked their way into, because Cat was in foul trouble early in the playoffs, Cat, you start the second quarter. And that had a lot of success for them. But is that going to be a clash to where, hey, Cat, those minutes that you have in the start of the second, Victor Wembanyama's out here. So, so it's like, but again, as that Thunder series rolled on, I know we already covered it, but the funniest part of that second half of Game 7 was Mitch Johnson trying desperately to avoid giving Luke Kornet minutes and being forced into giving Luke Kornet minutes in that fourth quarter. And so I think there's just a lot of that little Lego piece is what's interesting to me.
No, I'm right there with you. I think to the Knicks portion, I feel like I immediately go to Landry Shamet about like whose series it could be. Because I feel like he would be the most natural sub in for Josh Hart if it is a series in which Josh Hart does not play well. I think if we're talking X factors, he is going to loom the largest for the Knicks again, just because Wimby's going to roam off of him. He's going to have to not only make shots, but ultimately make quick decisions. If I'm not shooting threes, I'm driving. If I'm not driving, I'm flowing into handoffs immediately, et cetera, et cetera. And so if it is any kind of catch and hold for Josh Hart, or if Josh Hart starts the first three games of the series, he's 4 of 15 from three. I think that's where Landry Shamet is like, okay, we're kind of like size. I can defend, but I will just spread the floor in a way to where you can, it makes the roaming a little bit more uncomfortable. So I go there first with the Knicks to get to the first part of your question. Beyond that, I probably also lean Spurs, and I wonder like how comfortable some of the second unit guys are going to be. Because you mentioned Keldon Johnson, and I think he certainly perked up as the Thunder series went on. It's kind of felt like an up and down postseason run for him overall, which has been kind of odd. But I wonder, especially with Mitch Robinson, we'll say at least being a little hindered. We'll see how much the pinky affects him, et cetera. I'm curious to see like when Keldon Johnson checks in some of these games and what those drives are going to look like. And if we're going back to the offensive rebound a bit, like how much of an impact he can have on that front in this series. And I like the point you made about like maybe some of the early second quarter minutes with Cat and Wimby on the floor together. Because that feels like an underrated but important bellwether for both of those teams. Like you want to be able to be neutral or positive in any Wimby minutes that you can get. And if you're the Knicks, if we can match those minutes while Jalen Brunson gets a rest, we're going to see the mid-quarter break for Wimby. If that also coincides with Jalen Brunson coming in, it makes it easier for him to, if it's Luke Kornet, I'm going to probably see some level of drop. Or I can just kind of guard, get wing, pick and roll, get those switches and kind of poke at those matchups without having to worry about Wimby roaming it around the rim. Like that part gets fascinating. So I am curious to see what that part looks like. The other thing that kind of concerns is probably too strong. But like, as I just kind of think about different lineup combinations, I mentioned Jose Alvarado a little bit earlier. I do think his drives, his ability to initiate the offense without turning the ball over, and obviously the ball pressure defensively on the other end, could all loom pretty large in this series in terms of just random boost. And if he has the pull-up threes going, then it's just an entirely different deal. And the Knicks crowd is going to be rocking when those games are happening. But it does provide, sticking with the early second quarter type thing, it does also provide Wimby another option to roam off of, depending on who else is out there. And so, like, within that, we had the base question earlier, like, who is Wimby going to guard? Do you put him on Cat? Do you put him on Josh Hart, et cetera? To the roaming bit, is this a series where, I don't know, it's funny to ask coming off of the Thunder series where they had a lot of shooters he was comfortable roaming off of. I guess just the overall comfort of Wimby being able to pull that specific gambit with the Knicks and their lineups and with the way that they play. Like, I wonder, like, how much we're going to feel that difference in this series, if that makes sense.
Feel the difference if you're the Knicks, or feel the difference for the Spurs leaning in on it more?
I think the Spurs leaning in on it more. Because I think with OKC, again, salute to Alex Caruso early shot making, Cason Wallace later in the series, et cetera. But you could just walk in and say, cool, we can put Wimby on Lu Dort. We can put him on Cason Wallace. We can put him on Alex Caruso. There you go. With the New York Knicks, it's Josh Hart, and then it's maybe Jose Alvarado. Though again, like, he has shot relatively well, but like, that's kind of, that's two.
Well, I mean, so I think I think it's less the person and more the concept, depending on how they want Wimby to help and when they want him to help. Because Wimby will basically just look and say, "Okay, this is what y'all running. I'm take this person on the wing. I will be at the block, or I'm going to run up the middle of the floor to take this, and y'all rotate around me." So it's, I don't necessarily always base it on, "Hey, it's a non-shooter." Sometimes that just happens to be. And Josh Hart, I'm sure, will become a story. But for me, with Wembanyama, if you watch his rotations, it was interesting in that Thunder series, he was real declarative early on. But Oklahoma City, again, worked to make him pay and then worked to move him around the board and then worked to just play out of it. So I think it's going to be, okay, can the Spurs reestablish that coming off a series against the team that was just like, you know what, we're absolutely tired of you doing this no more. And he still was working to do it towards the end of that series. You know, it's not like he's just going to stop. And so it's more so, okay, what do the Knicks show? How does Wimby adjust to it? And then that becomes the back and forth more than anything. Now, I'm intrigued to see, okay, what's the physicality going to be from the Knicks defense? Will they be able to match and kind of put Wimby in certain scenarios? Will they be able to kind of be as physical with the Spurs guards? Like, what's that look like for them? So it's a fascinating series for me.
No, I like that. I guess quickly to hang there, that also kind of influences my thoughts on who you start on Wimby. I think it became, boy, did it become a story in that Thunder series, how physical Isaiah Hartenstein was being with Victor Wembanyama. It wasn't just we have a big on him. It's we have a big on him and we are grabbing him, holding him before his rolls, on these box outs were being super physical, before the screens were doing this, etc. With Cat, he is incredibly good at basketball. He is incredibly important to what the New York Knicks want to do on both ends. Can Cat find a way to be that physical against Wimby whenever they are matched up without getting into foul trouble? And conversely, Mitchell Robinson, when you are in, especially in light of the finger injury, can you be physical with Victor Wembanyama whenever your minutes match up without getting in foul trouble? Because I think as you, with the Knicks, having Cat, who, as we talked about, has largely just done his job defensively in this postseason run, Mitchell Robinson to be a very good defender. Ideally, both of those guys do their job, and then because we want to, we can flow into some OG Anunoby at the five. It becomes a different series entirely if we have to go to OG at the five because we don't have our bigs available or because our bigs are getting baked in some kind of area. So, like, the physicality bit, like, I don't care too much about the ref talk, but I do think in terms of the actual matchup and game planning, being able to be physical in the right way goes a long way to, let's stifle some of the Wimby roles and take away some of the paint impact. But also, we want to make sure our guys are actually available so we can get into some of the lineups that we want to get into. Last thing I'll say, I'll toss it back to you, Steve. I was trying to look up some of the lineup data yesterday to see how often we had seen the double big group for the Knicks against the Spurs. Don't think we saw it in the regular season. In the NBA Cup, we got it for 2 minutes. And I think the Knicks went 1 of 6 from the field in those 2 minutes. So it's just like, I just have a very basic, how often do the Knicks want to get to that alignment against the Spurs? When do they think it's best to get to that alignment? And then obviously attached to that, how successful will it be? And how do the Spurs kind of want to match up when they go there? Because I feel like during the regular season, we got to see some Wimby and Luke Kornet minutes sprinkled in. Do we get at any point of the series Mitchell Robinson and Cat on the floor while Luke Kornet and Wimby are on the floor at the same time? Is that a button that either one of those coaches want to push? Like, that also fascinates me as in the lead up to this series.
Bro wants quadruple big. I see what's going on.
Bring back the real powerful. No, I am fascinated. We've seen it. Haven't really seen it against each other. So, like, I am fascinated by that bit. I'm trying to think, is there anything else pressing for you in this series, D, as we get into it?
Nah, I can't wait to see the attempts. You know, I think both these teams have earned the right to be here. So it's just like excited to see what they try to do to each other and excited to see if they continue on this high level of confidence. Like, they got here based on how well they played. And I'm sure either side believes this is our chance, this is our moment. And that can change how a team operates on both ends of the floor. That can change what a team looks like on both ends of the floor. And so who's gonna land the first punch? Like, I mean, Cat Brunson, the Knicks have been rolling, the bench has been bought in, the Spurs have defended their tails off and attacked and played with force. So who's going to win this championship? Because I feel like if you're the Knicks, we're finally here. This is our shot. And if the Spurs, we got here. No one thought we'd get here this early. And this is our chance. So I'm intrigued to see the level of the feeling out process in game one, the level of desperation that shows up as this series goes on. I think it'll be fun to watch.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I'm super excited about this one. I will just quickly say before we go to break, one, it's kind of wild to me that the Spurs have made this run in year one. Like, we talked about it a little bit on Friday, but like, Wimby's in the playoffs, Wimby is in the finals already. I was looking back through some of my season prediction stuff before the year started, Steve. Thunder Spurs was my first round matchup. Like, I thought, hey, Wimby's going to be healthier. This team's going to be good. They make the playoffs. It's a series. It's a tough series against OKC. They take their lumps. Then next year, they kind of, you know, they take off. That being the Western Conference Finals instead, and the Spurs winning that series on the road is absolutely absurd to me, complimentary. So just a salute to them. I want to see what this looks like. And I was going to say quickly on the offensive rebounding front, both the Knicks and the Spurs have been pretty good on the offensive glass. They've both been very good on the defensive glass. So far in this postseason, even the regular season, like the rebounding was solid for both. So that is going to be a natural margin. Mitchell Robinson, one of the best offensive rebounders that we have in the league. And so, as you mentioned already, Steve, the health kind of looms large there. So we'll see what happens on that front. And the Spurs, you can get it from anyone. Victor Wembanyama has been a monster on the offensive glass pretty much all postseason long. Julian Champagne can fly in. The guards can fly in. Luke Kornet is going to generate some extra opportunities too. That is an important margin to pay attention to when this series tips off, but I'm excited. But from here, we're going to take a break. And when we return, we shift to the W. The Golden State Valkyries have been very good, Steve. We want to talk about them. And I also have some Fever defense questions for you in particular in light of some of the discourse that I have seen over the past couple of days. But we will return. Stick with us. And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot as we shift to the WNBA. It is Commissioner's Cup week, Steve. Commissioner's Cup play starts this week, so it's going to be a whole lot of interconference battles. I'm excited about that. As we teased on Friday, we did sprinkle in some love to the Golden State Valkyries. We said, hey, you've been like the one team at the top of the standings that we haven't done a full-blown segment on yet. We're showing you your love now, but we are talking about you very soon. We're going to talk about the Golden State Valkyries today. It is, once again, very funnily timed as the Las Vegas Aces, coming off of two straight losses, said, hey, actually, what if we just figure out your help in the second half and we win the game and snap our losing streak? So great timing on our part, but the Golden State Valkyries have still been a very good team. Fifth in offense, third in defense, second in net rating so far, Steve, and kind of going under the radar, but very important to their overall offensive formula. No team turning the ball over less on a lower rate of their possessions than the Golden State Valkyries. As you recently tweeted, hey, this team is going to defend, this team is going to drive, and this team is going to get up threes, and they have largely done that. So I guess just to toss it to you, Steve, what have been your general impressions of this Valkyries team so far? What have you liked about them?
I was going to say that, but you said it. So I think the biggest thing is just the identity that they have as a team is that they know who they are. And I think that has value, especially in this expanded W, especially early in the season. You get a jump on teams because we play a very specific style every single night. Do they have all of the kind of three-point shooters? Do they have all of the drivers? Do they have the strongest offense? Not particularly. Do they care? Not particularly. No. They're going to let it fly from three. And so, you want to play off Gabby Williams? It's going up. You want to play off Veronica Burton? It's going up. You want to play off Janelle Salon? It's going up. Now, intriguing how the hot start from three for Salon has kind of turned a little bit, but the volume is there, so people are happy. So I'll leave that alone. But we have versatility. We have size we can put out there. We have multiple players who can drive and kick and get in the paint and put pressure on you. And so you look up and you got to deal with Kayla Thorne and Zandel Asini and Tippes and Caitlin Chen out there balling. So I think it's just they know what they can do every single night and they work towards it. Now, it's going to be interesting to see how that unfolds as the season goes on. because when you have an active defense like this, it can be of your benefit. You're going to pressure the ball. You can throw in traps and pick and roll. Your weak side can be in. You can close back out. But there is a level of defense they have to play to have a level of success. And so even when they're able to kind of win some of these shootout type games, right, where, okay, we can beat you Indiana 90-80, okay, we can hold you to 70 points. What do we do when our shots aren't necessarily falling? How do we win some of those? And so it's like, okay, we've seen them be overwhelming against some of these teams defensively, Mercury, Liberty as well. We've also seen when teams figure them out to a degree, okay, now you have to score. It feels a little different. And so the Aces just kind of turning up the heat and saying, you know what? Yeah, it's great that you're wanting to show this level of help toward Asia Wilson. You're trying to put two on the wall against Jackie Young. We're going to play out of that. And now, ooh, we're not getting the same amount of stops. Instead of this being a 6-8 or we can make an 8-0 run, we're down 14-15. And now we're trying to figure out how to A, turn up our defense, and B, keep pace offensively. So that's where, okay, how do they refine things as the season goes on? But they made a statement early. Which I think is very important. You get a hot start, you put yourself in a good position.
No, I think that part's fair. Like I asked the Aces post game, just how they dealt with that Valkyrie's help, and like just seeing the tempo perk up a little bit more. You saw the mix of like pin in and flare screens on the backside, and you also saw some of the late diving from the Lissa Smith. Got busy with cuts. Got busy on the offensive glass, and so. There are ways to poke at this defense, but to your point and to the Valkyries' credit, they do such a good job of setting the tone defensively that you can't really get to that stuff consistently, or at the very least, that hasn't been the story so far this year. And so if you're talking about the Golden State Valkyries, the offense has been intriguing to me, but you kind of have to start with their defense, the way that they pressure you, headlined by Veronica Burton at the point of attack. You add Gabby Williams to help strengthen what was already a really good defense last year. And so having those two patently unfair, and now Kayla Thornton becomes like your third best defender on the perimeter. Like, that doesn't seem like that's how that's supposed to work. And then Kia Stokes, who's just starting at center and has been one of the best rim protectors in basketball to start the year. Like, you just have a quartet in your starting lineup that's kind of absurd. And Kyla Charles will also just take on tough defensive assignments. She's no slouch either. And so you don't really have weak points to poke at with their starting group. And so you're in a headlock, and then off the bench, here comes Tiffy Hayes, who's just ready to drive all over the place. Caitlin Chin with her mix of driving and shot making. On top of that, Janelle Salon, who Steve, as you already know, is one of my favorite players in the league. Hey, that's a cool shot contest you got there. What if the ball went in the basket anyway? Now, as you mentioned, it has cooled off from the start of the year, where she was outperforming her shot quality by like 30 percentage points. Like, that was never going to sustain. So it is a bit unfortunate that that has dropped. But that threat still remains. And so when you can mix in that kind of shot making, Zan Lassini as well with her high release point, you're just always in a fight with the Golden State Valkyries. But to the defense, the early ball pressure, the screen navigation, the incredibly active help, whether that is at the nail early or as we saw a lot against the Aces and going back to their matchups from last year, hey, here's some space for you. You take two dribbles, wait, here are three bodies coming at you late now, and you got to try to make kickouts against those active hands. It's a scary proposition for offenses when you know the defense that you're facing wants to send help, but you don't have a beat on when they're going to. And on top of that, the players that are coming with that help are incredibly good and handsy. You really have to think through how you want to attack this Valkyries group. And so, like, I commend them for continuing that formula from last year on the defensive end, being able to mix that in. They're one of the highest help rate teams in terms of drives in the league. They've been one of the best pick and roll defenses in basketball. They've been very good against drives. That juices the transition attack where, as you've already talked about, Steve, we don't mind driving. We don't mind letting it fly. And so you feel that most in transition with Veronica Burton, Gabby Williams in particular, getting downhill and some of the wing, you know, some of the wing feeling, the corner feeling, you get to those catch and shoot three looks. The offense has been pretty intriguing to me, Steve. As I was looking at some of the numbers and looking at, like, okay, what feels different from last year? Because watching them, it does feel like a slightly different attack, even if the overall of we want to put pressure on you getting downhill remains the same. And so as you get into some of the things that have shifted from last year, they were running about 92 pick and rolls per 100 possessions last year. That is down to around 76 so far this year. The pick and rolls have pretty much been swapped out with dribble handoffs, which makes sense considering the personnel. They've gone from around 28 per 100 possessions last year. That is up to 39 so far this year. Aisha Lasons have jumped up from around 16 per 100 last year to 26 this year. Post-up volume has gone down. And I think bouncing off of something that you mentioned a little bit earlier with some of their perimeter players just being willing to let it fly, that's where I've been super intrigued by Veronica Burton, as I talked about in the preseason, and with Gabby Williams so far. Their three-point percentage was always going to be kind of a bellwether to their offensive ceiling, but their comfort when they see any sort of under, whether that's against a handoff or a pick and roll, to just saying, actually, I will just take a dribble, steady myself, and I will fire this thing. I am not afraid to take these shots against unders. It increases their flow, and as both of them are shooting over 40% from three to start the year, this is where you really feel, crap, what do we do? Because if we're giving them these shots to take away the drives and they're making them, we may have to think about providing a little bit more pressure, which may open up the drives, which very quickly, Steve, averaging nearly 53 drives per 100 possessions this year. Not only is that first in W, they are the only team above 50 per 100. They're not just the most voluminous driving team in the league. Like, there is a gap between what they do. And that overall pressure that they put on teams is astounding. The graphic's up for the people watching on YouTube, but Gabby Williams in particular, seeing her three-point volume skyrocket the way that it has, her comfort taking off the dribble threes, and the percentage on those, like, we will see if this sustains, because I think last year in Seattle, she had a hot start from three, but those were mostly spot-ups. If that sustains with this volume of off-the-dribble stuff on top of that, like, she just feels like a totally different player. And this is where, like, she hasn't finished at her usual level yet this year. Veronica Burton hasn't finished at her usual level yet this year. You would anticipate that perking up at some point. And so I've been fascinated by how this offense has looked and with some of the aggression that we've just seen from the perimeter players.
Oh, I mean, I think this is the beauty of Golden State and why the Gabby Williams fit was so good. And why, based on the success we saw from Veronica Burton and Kayla Thornton last year, it's okay. I can have more freedom to do different things offensively. So I have the ability to get downhill. I have the ability to take these threes. I'm a part of this offense. But you're not depending on me to do X, Y, and Z specifically. I can just go out and play. So we've always kind of looked and been like, okay, are we going to get an unlocked Gabby Williams? We see for a couple weeks, and it's like, okay, well, defenses are responding with this, or now the Storm are doing this. So it wasn't, you know, they just kind of went away from it. Now it's like, no, I'm actively involved. And so if you want to play off me, I have the room to take this shot. I'm going to let it fly. I'm going to get downhill. Get to drive and kick, get to my spots. And I think we've seen, you know, Veronica Burton, important to see her build on last season, as far as, you know, what the aggression that I showed last year is just me. Like, this is just who I am as a basketball player. So I'm going to get downhill. I'm not afraid to hit you. If I have the space, take the shot, I'm going to take it. I'm also going to run the team in a way, you know, because I think one of the secret things about Golden State, they do have some movement. So you mentioned the dribble handoffs. You mentioned the pick and roll. Okay, but if you want to switch, okay, we have people who can drive and find gaps. And now it's on you to say, hey, are you going to show help? Are we going to be able to win this matchup? How much pressure are we able to put on you in different ways? Can all of your players guard? Because if we can just find our way into the paint, make you help enough, will that open up a layup? Will that open up a three? Like, that's the juice that Golden State plays with. And so that's what I want to see. How does that grow? Especially, I'm intrigued to see how it looks over the next, you know, two, three games for the Valkyries, if you think about it. They're facing a Portland Fire team that has been tricky to really put a thumb on for defenses this year because of the way that they flow offensively. And there's not necessarily one specific set thing they're doing. And the more they play, the more they believe in it, and the more they understand the counter. So, okay, we have a Golden State defense who's very active. Portland Fire defense that has a level of activity as well. But how does that kind of match up? How does that mesh, especially with Golden State Valkyries defensive personnel? Then they have to go play the Lynx. And we've seen how well the Lynx have played. And we've seen the Lynx at times struggle with physical defenses. But also, the more they play them, the more it's like, you know what? We're kind of tired of y'all. So they're getting more comfortable with teams that have that defensive mindset, play with that physicality. Then you got to face the Aces again after, you know, they win the ball haul and had some fun. So interesting stretch for the Valks.
Interesting stretch indeed. I think final notes that I have on the Valkyries before we move. Just looking at some of the other team-based numbers for them so far. Sixth in offensive rebound and defensive rebound rate so far. So about average, which with the collective size they play with, it feels a little underwhelming, at least on the defensive front. So we will keep an eye on what that part looks like. You already mentioned how teams try to be physical with Golden State or some of the bogging down that you may see. Only the Portland Fire has seen switches on a higher rate of their pick and rolls than the Golden State Valkyries. And so some of that is, like, we can poke at some matchups, as we saw in a very recent game that's going to help segue into the next segment. And so they can poke at some matchups and then get into their drivers and force help and things like that. But there is also a level of team saying, do we really fear some of your best players off the bounce like this? Like, we can kind of flatten you out and force you to work deeper into the clock. And so, as you mentioned, Steve, I'm curious to see as the sample grows, how much of the off the dribble shooting and creation is sustainable for them. Will we see the drive efficiency team-wide kind of perk up? Because, again, they're leading the W in drives per game or drives per 100 possessions. The efficiency on those drives hasn't been up to snuff for them so far. So, like, where does that kind of normalize is going to be interesting to me. But this is one of my favorite teams to watch play. Like, give me an active defense and I'm already kind of in. And when you have the volume of defenders that they have, actually, that would be my free throw for you before we move to this next segment, Steve. How many all-defense candidates do you think the Valkyries have right now?
Two.
Okay. Veronica and Gabby?
How many?
Will those be the two?
Yeah. How many do you think they have?
I'd probably write down four. I think I'm with you that the two serious ones are probably Veronica Burton and Gabby Williams, or the most serious of the group is probably those two. But I will again say, like, Kia Stokes' per minute basis has been kind of absurd to start the year. So I think where she lands minute wise is probably going to be the biggest thing for me on that front. And then Kayla Thornton will just defend a little bit of everyone. And like what she's doing as a helper in turn, and also in addition to like the matchup versatility, I think is pretty impressive. So if I'm making my super long list, I started it over the weekend, by the way. Yeah, like I would at least write four names down for Golden State. And then if I'm actually making a fictional team, it'll probably be those two. So that's where we're at. We're teasing the list early, Steve. We got some thoughts.
Let's hang right there. By started it, what does that mean?
Well, see, what I generally like to do very early in the season before I get into like, okay, what are the pick and roll numbers, what are the on off, yada yada yada, is generally like list all the teams down and like, okay, who have I enjoyed on defense to start the year?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's literally just a team by team, like who have I liked. So like Atlanta, like Jordan Canada, Ryan Howard, Alicia Gray's been pretty good, okay. But I think she's been behind those two. Angel Reese's been very good. So it's like, okay, who have I enjoyed? You go team by team, you go from there. And then as the season grows, okay, well, you just had a hot start, you're tailing off. We can kind of erase that name, whatever. And then when it's time for us to have our check-ins for like all defense stuff like that, that's where I get into what are you doing against drives? What are you doing in pick and roll? What are the on-off numbers looking like? You kind of go from there and then you build out like the official teams, but you're keeping eyes on players. Like that's how I like to approach it at the very least.
Nice.
But yeah, we're having some fun. Shout out to the back.
I have three questions. How many notes apps notes do you have for this?
How many notes do I have total, or how many do I have for like all defense though?
Yeah, just for this defensive list concept.
Oh. It's normally two. Like the team name to
get very good.
The team list for the go ahead.
Number two, very quickly, how many names do you have down right now?
I haven't finished it yet. And so we will get there. We're north of 20. I'll put it that way.
Oh, my. Okay. All right. And number three, how many names do you have from the Indiana Fever?
Ooh, that is, you are very good at this. Wow. I have one name written down right now. I don't know if I would have that player in just as like a firm all defense candidate right now, but I at least have a name written down. And so from there, Steve, let's talk about the Indiana Fever and their defense. We are a week and a half, 2 weeks removed from talking about the Indiana Fever and say like just a general ceiling/floor check-in. I went back to the episode to listen to what we said. And like in the midst of that conversation, we had a graphic about some of the schematic changes that the Fever have had. But it's like, hey, this is pretty interesting. Let's see how it progresses. The Indiana Fever have lost their last two games, which is not a big deal in a vacuum. However, the way that they have lost these two games to the Golden State Valkyries, who we just talked about, and to the Portland Fire, who were loosely referenced a little bit earlier, in the mismatch hunting that took place late in that Valkyries game and pretty much throughout that entire Portland Fire game has led to a lot of understandable angst among Fever faithful and everything else. And so like, I wanted to kind of broaden the scope of the conversation before getting into like the Caitlin of it all. Cause that is obviously the loudest piece of this. Going back to the Indiana Fever, kind of shifting things defensively, not switching as often as they did off the ball last year, but have been fine at it. They're switching a lot more in pick and roll this year. They had a switch rate of 16% last season. That is up to 30% so far this year. That is tops in the WNBA. funny enough, as they've switched a lot more, volume's gone up, etc., their defense when switching is better than it was last year, which is funny when you consider the backdrop of this entire conversation. And I think just in general, Steve, like obviously you know this as someone that has played basketball, watched a bunch of basketball, coached basketball, etc. There is no such thing as a perfect defensive scheme. You pick the one that is best for your personnel slash your opponent. We want to take away X and Y, and we just kind of have to live with if we get beat by Z, that is just the weakness of the scheme. And so with the Fever opting to switch more this year, at least in pick and roll, they are saying we don't want to be in rotation as much as we were last year, as they were one of the teams that put Aaliyah Boston at the level of bunch, Natasha Howard at the level of bunch, et cetera. We want to dial that back. We want to flatten out actions. And to that point, when you look at what their shot profile is defensively and just the terms of shots that they're giving up, the three-point rate has dropped dramatically from last year. Teams are just not taking as many threes against the Indiana Fever as they were last year. Not taking as many mid-range shots. The rim rate is up. They are contesting more shots than they did last year, or contesting shots at a higher rate last year. And the kicker for me, Steve, the overall shot quality, Second Spectrum tracks this based on like who's taking the shot, where they're taking it from, what type of shot it is, how close the defender is to contesting, et cetera, et cetera. Their expected shot quality has gone from 48% to about 47%. Mm-hmm. The defense has looked different than last year, and at least statistically has been better. And heading into the Portland Fire game, in which it was not a good time for pretty much anyone involved in that basketball game, they were fourth in defensive rating. Like they had once again, early season sample, et cetera, but they had once again taken a step. And so for me, it is just like, how do we balance acknowledging the bad that we've seen from the Indiana Fever over these last two games without throwing out everything that they are doing and everything that they are building? Like that has,
Let's hold right here. Let's hold right here because apparently you've been doing some discourse about this. There's some discourse about this that I've missed out on. So it's interesting. I think that, I mean, if you look at the story of the Fever, they gave up 104, but then they gave 107 to Dallas and 104 to Washington in like two of the first three games. And it was very clear, okay, if the defense is going to be this, they're going to be in trouble. And then they went to the switching against Seattle, against Portland, against Golden State, and found a level of success. Now, here's the tricky part, right? Whatever you do poorly defensively is going to have a volume. It's going to be loud. And especially when it becomes to this player's getting attacked, this player's getting beat, this is happening here. So I think the interesting point is now going to be, how do they handle this going forward over the next few games? Because Golden State and Portland were both rematches, right? So you had 6 days off before you played Golden State again. They said, nah, we're going to get this one. And then Portland said, yeah, we're going to... All the things we couldn't do against you in Indiana, we're going to do to you in Portland. And so, you know, they're a guard heavy screen team. And if you're going to switch, okay, we know it's coming. That's the thing. If we know it's coming, we know we can get certain specific things. And now for Indiana, the challenge is going to be, well, are the Dream and Liberty going to pick up on this and also do this to us? Or are we going to have to figure this out? And I think it's interesting because I think they had some pretty good nuance when it came to not just switching, but also scramming out. And so how much of that is now them communicating and being smart about it, or are they just kind of doing it automatically, right? That's where I think it gets interesting, because there's sometimes it's like, okay, you switch an empty side pick and roll, and then Caitlin Clark rotated to Megan Gustafson. And I'm like, I get the idea here, but also, did you have to do that one? So I think it's just kind of nailing down and getting back to the activity. But the switching made them guard. It kept them set. Kept them out of rotation, made them have a level of activity. You know, that combined with Lexi Hall being put in starting lineup was a positive for them. Now you got to figure out, okay, can we contain the drive? Can we keep the ball in front? Can we make multiple efforts? Can we stay in our help positions? Like, can we be better at these portions of the program to where we're in a stronger position? You know, and so it's not just, okay, it's one-on-one here. Okay, contain, contest, get a stop, run. That's my overall theory. Now, I don't know who's been yelling, because the funny part about that Indiana-Portland game is it started out with an 8-2 run from Indiana. So, I mean, it's just, this is basketball.
Yeah, I think broader strokes for the Indiana Fever and the way that they're discussed. Like, there just seems to be a lot of angst around Stephanie White / Caitlin Clark in general, and, like, what is the usage offensively and what is the scheme defensively. And I don't think there's anything wrong with like having just an active, hey, what is the plan? What works about it? What doesn't work about it? Because you just want to learn about those things as a basketball fan. And if you're rooting for the Fever, like we were a game away from the finals, and now Caitlin Clark is back. Is she going to take us over the top? Thus, are we going to have the schemes and structure in place for us to actually get over the top this year? Because we think we had the talent to do so. So I don't think any of that is inherently wrong. But I think to your point, like I think it's smart for you to point out the fact that these were rematches, like these teams that we have beaten already. They want to find something else to poke at so they can beat us as well. And I think the Valkyries did that late, and the Fire sure as heck did that. And I think what's kind of annoyed, one of the many things that has annoyed me about the Portland Fire game conversation has been just a lack of credit being given to the Portland Fire. Like, it is true, the Indiana Fever want to switch more. I think within that, the Fire were smart about not only saying, hey, let's poke at Caitlin Clark or let's poke at Kelsey Mitchell, et cetera. Let's also make sure we have some exchanges on the weak side. And so now, Aaliyah Boston, you are above the break guarding Emily Inkster or guarding a big. If you're going to send help, your help is going to come from someone small. And if it's come from someone small, that likely means we have another shooter that we can kick the ball out to. The Fire, as we've talked about on this podcast, have been very, very, very smart and intentional about their spacing principles all year long, whether they make shots or not. And it's just like, we could just acknowledge that part versus, whoop, the whole scheme sucks. Let's throw it out. It's like, no, let's talk about what happened. Now, I do have some numbers on the Caitlin Clark front since these last two now, games have before, been understandably loud. But go ahead.
Well, before you get to your numbers, I know you're fired up about this one today. I think what I'll say quickly to the Caitlin Clark portion is you have to do a better job of doing your work early. And I think what stood out to me in the Portland game was just a lack of anticipation and feel for what was happening. That part can't happen. If you're gonna get cooked, you're gonna get cooked. I mean, man, everyone who's played basketball has had a matchup or had something that where, okay, dang, I just don't have it today, or I'm getting roasted. But when you just kind of let the offensive player lead the dance to a degree, you know, like these aren't, how active are these switches? Are these drop adjacent type switches? And now there's not really help built in for you because of how the Fire spaced the floor. So now, okay, are you funneling it towards where the help could be? Or are you letting them just kind of lead the dance, get a bump on you, and now get to their spot? You got to kind of give yourself an opportunity to, all right, cool, I'm taking this switch, if we know we're switching, I'm sending you this way, or I'm going to keep it in front. I know my help's on this side, but there's just got to be a little bit more juice to it. I think if especially if teams are going to kind of put the bullseye on you a little bit, you can do your job even if you're not doing your job to a degree, if that makes sense to any of the hoopers out there. But if you're going to kind of allow, okay, well, here we go. I don't know.
It gets tough. It gets tough.
Bridget Carlton and Carla Lay was like, yeah, well, you know, you're right, Bop.
Sarah Ashley Barkley, yeah,
I'll take this. Freedom of movement. You don't want to get a foul. Now guess what? Oops.
And that's so, where it gets hazy. I think that's fair. And like I'm so glad you said this. I feel better about tweeting out. Like, we have seen Caitlin be a do your job defender. She just has to get back to doing her work early and then kind of funneling in that way. And so I thought you nailed it anyway, but now I feel even better about saying it because you are much smarter than I am. Now, to the Caitlin Clark numbers for the people that aren't watching on YouTube. If it's felt like teams are just putting Caitlin more in action, like these last two games have been incredibly loud, and that's why we're here. But overall this season, we have seen an uptick of teams saying, where is Caitlin Clark in light of the switching scheme? So Caitlin being targeted as the pick and roll screener defender, let's get the switch, et cetera. It's about 3 picks per 100 possessions last year. That is up to 6.9 so far this year. Isolations defended per 100 possessions, it was around 3 per 100 last year. It's over 10 so far this year. And in terms of the total number, she has defended more isolations than anyone in the league. In terms of drives, whether out of isolation or what have you, it was around 9 per 100 possessions last year. It's up to 15.1 so far this year. And to the drive portion in particular, and I think that gets into, as you said, Steve, some of the prep that Caitlin can do, some of the team-wide context around Caitlin to make life a little bit easier. Want to pull up what it's looked like for her this season. First 4 games of her year was defending about 11 drives per 100 possession. Over the last 2 games, up to 22. that is an insane jump. And again, speaks to, hey, let's actually make this a focal point of the game plan versus let's get this into the flow. Allowed about a point per possession on drives in the first four games, up to nearly 1.2 points per possession over the last two. That's not tenable. The blow-by rate on those drives actually been stingier over the last two games, about 24% over the first four, around 19% in the last two. And the help defense rate, which I think to the Portland example, how they space around these isolations and things, kicks in here. Fever helped on around 52% of Caitlin's drives in the first four games, down to 33.3% over these last two games. And so that is where, to your point, Steve, there has to be some early prep from Caitlin to be able to navigate some of this stuff. But I do also think, and I wonder how much game plan specific stuff the Fever want to get into when it comes to their help decisions versus like establishing a base. But I do wonder if there are some pockets in which, okay, Aaliyah, you may be spaced on the wing intentionally, but we just have to trust that we can zone up behind that. You just kind of have to be lowest on the floor. Or you are spaced on the wing right now. You just have to talk. You'd have to switch assignments with your teammate right now in anticipation of some of these attacks. Like, is there more nuance from the team itself to kind of safeguard against some of these Caitlin attacks? I think it is a little bit of both on that front. Is that fair?
I mean, you got to win the positioning battle. What you may lack in foot speed, or you may lack in a team's desire to go at you, you have to make up with your brain, in my opinion. And so I got to know, okay, where is my help? Where can I not get beat? Can I not get beat middle here? You know, I got to anticipate. I got to try and make you do something different. It can't just be comfortable drives, if that makes sense. And an offensive player getting to their spot, if that makes sense. And so I think that's probably the difference you've seen in the last two games is, okay, working, trying to slide the puppies a little bit, but are you sliding them because of what the offensive player is doing, or are you sliding them with a purpose of your own as a defensive player? Yeah. But to me, there's a difference. Yeah, I mean, we've seen certain defenders be able to handle certain matchups only because they're just in the right spot. Beats the spot, put your hands up. You get beat. But when you end up giving the mix of get beat on a drive, get beat on a pull-up, you got to take one off the board. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's fair. And like, we saw that early on, very early on in the Fire game and early on in the Valkyries game. It just, as the game progressed, it was like, ooh, well, this seems less than ideal. And so like the base question I wanted to ask you, Steve, I guess to kind of close this portion out, was if you felt like this was just, these two games were an example of we cannot allow this, or did you feel like this is a legitimate problem that could continue to perk up for the Fever? Because I just kind of, I'm more so viewed as.
I mean, it's an issue because they need stops. But I think it, for me personally, it ties into the larger thing for Indiana, which is where, okay, when you did get stops, how quick did you go offensively? Did you go too quick and now you're having to play defense again? And so I think there's like a weird volume battle for the Fever right now where it's like, okay, the offense is doing this. Now our defense is doing that. We're this team. We saw that during the win streak, right? They get that combination, that blend. They feel pretty comfortable. You're going to have to navigate the nights where your defense is getting dinged a little bit and that can't bleed into your offense. And so are you executing in the half court? Are you getting the type of shots you want? Are you giving your defense a chance to reset? That's going to be their battle, I think. Because they have to learn how to win in different ways, but they have to be able to navigate different scenarios. And so now if you're struggling offensively and now Portland's getting transition buckets on top of feeling like they can get you in the half court, and now you're turning the ball over, you're not necessarily getting into what you want, okay, you've now gotten dinged at both of the things. Your formula is now altered. Can you handle that? I think that's where, like, let's take a real quick a team like the Liberty. Has it been the best start for them? No. Have they had to figure out a whole bunch of different things in different type of games? Yes. That should probably have value for them going on in the future. I think this is a stretch for the Fever where, okay, we got to get back to non-negotiables. Our defense has to be this, but it can't affect our offense.
Well, I think that's fair. And I think that's where, even going to the Portland Fire game, it was interesting to me to see them. They were getting beat on the switches, and Caitlin in particular was getting beat on the switches, but like they didn't stay there. Like, hey, let's mix in some switch and double. Let's just, if they try to put her in action again, let's actually just flat out hedge this or blitz this. Like, there were tweaks being made, and ultimately they did not go well as the Fire won that game handily. But you zoom out, and I tweeted something similar about the switch and doubles in particular. If they end up nailing more of that as the year goes on, it's going to be interesting to kind of look back on the game like, ooh, this may have been the turning point to where they really said, okay, we got to nail this for when we need it, et cetera. And so, like, these can just be legit learning opportunities for the defense to be able to mix in more things. So as they get to the postseason, again, we got a long way to go. But once we get there, we have some things in our back pocket now that we got to tap into. So to answer my own question, this feels more like this is an example of what cannot happen versus teams have found a thing with the Fever and now they're going to get browbeat and their defense is going to be bad. Like, I'm just not there. I may end up being wrong by the end of the year, but that's not where I'm at to start. A couple of quick things for me, Steve, before we get out of here. One, I wanted to laugh at myself, as you know, we did our games of the weekend segment on Friday. Was very excited about Dreamfire. Very excited watching that first half back. And then you got to the second half, it's like, oh, so the Dream said enough, huh? Well, that takes a little bit of steam out of that. So, you know, it is what it is on that front. But shout out to the Atlanta Dream, another win as they remain towards top of the Eastern Conference standing. Second thing, as I was watching Sun Sparks on Saturday, the start of the game from Layla Lacan made me so incredibly happy. Where she's firing from three, she's getting downhill, she's picking pockets at half court and getting transition baskets. Just a general welcome back to Layla Lacan, who should add some legit structure to a Connecticut Sun team that really needs it. So I wanted to sprinkle that in before we got out of here. Can I ask you one free throw before we go?
Absolutely.
Unless you have.
Absolutely.
What is your concern level with the Phoenix Mercury right now? If you had to put a number on it. Okay.
The talent I believe in. You are putting yourself in a very dangerous position, especially considering the W has more teams. I mean, it's the same reason why the Liberal was, it was like, hey, you put yourself in a box. But with this fall, your path is a lot harder. Think about the Mercury right now. They're three games behind the Liberty, who are the eighth seed right now. So you got some ground to make up. And if you don't start making it up soon, you're going to end up with a date with the Lynx or the Dream or the whoever's the one seed, the Aces. Like, you gotta pick this up pretty quick. I think for me, I'm more concerned that the ball's not moving the same way to a degree. And defensively, you've kind of lost a hint there. So you better, this league's too competitive. You better wake it up.
Yeah, it was interesting to hear Nate Tibbetts and Alyssa Thomas to a certain degree kind of speak like they lost again over the weekend, but it felt like a step in the right direction. Like, that is cool. But to your point, these do have to start turning into wins pretty soon. That you just don't want to dig yourself out of that deep of a hole. The defense has just felt so weird to me all year long. And one of the things I asked Nate ahead of their Aces matchup to start the year was like, weird offseason, truncated training camp, et cetera. You got players out. Monika Cole-McConnie was overseas at that point, et cetera. It's like, how are you kind of balancing the full court pressure bit that y'all really leaned into last year in light of missing folks, trying to establish your identity, and just the overall stamina of it because they had a back-to-back, you know, that next day. And it's just, Monika's come back and they've mixed in some of the full court pressure, but it hasn't been a ton of it. Like, I just haven't felt the Mercury. I think it's kind of been my biggest issue with their defense. Like, if you lose a rep, you lose a rep, but there's just a lack of physicality that I'm seeing with them. And I think that also kind of bleeds into some of the very loud off ball mishaps that they've had defensively to start the year. And so we'll probably end up doing like a full Mercury thing soon, especially if they don't turn it around. But I wanted to check the temperature. I don't think I've asked you personally how you felt about this Mercury start so far, so I wanted to get your thoughts on Wax before we get out of here. But to that end, thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of The Dunker Spot. Please subscribe if you haven't already. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel if you haven't already. That's where our finals conversations are going to go. Subscribe to the Yahoo Sports main channel. That is where our WNBA commentary is going. So make sure you are subscribed to both to catch all of our awesome analysis. You can follow me on socials at NikaiasNBA. You can follow Steve on socials at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.